Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is Side 2 of For the Record Program Number 612, Miscellaneous Articles and Updates. This is being recorded on that last day of September, number 30 of 2007. As I say so often, please utilize the remarkable amount of information available on the Spitfire website at www.spitfirelist.com and linked websites. There's a veritable cornucopia of information, a vast amount of printed and audio information available on that and linked websites, so please utilize it. And if you utilize it, among the things that you're going to know about, and something you're going to know a great deal about, is a name that is really central to an understanding of the development and operation of industrial capitalism, but a name most people have never heard, namely I.G. Farben. I.G. Farben was the German chemical industry, German chemical company, which pretty much represented a monopoly, a coalescing of the various German dyestuffs companies in the chemical industry of Germany into one giant monopoly. But beyond that, that company had arrangements with companies like similar companies around the world to monopolize the various markets, the pharmaceutical markets, the chemical markets, and others. And therefore, IG Farben was the epicenter of a cartel, an international monopoly in numerous fields. The numbers of companies, powerful companies, that had cartel agreements with IG Farben couldn't be exaggerated. Among them, Standard Oil of New Jersey, the largest and most powerful of the Standard Oil companies, and among the most important of the cartel agreements that Standard had with IG was the Standard IG Agreement of 1929. That agreement basically was an agreement over the Fischer-Tropsch process. That was the hydrogenation process to, among other things, turn coal into oil. And since Germany had large coal reserves but no domestic petroleum reserves, the ability to do that was seen as a key to basically assuring Germany's industrial war-making capacity in the motor age. Eventually, there was a capped catalyst that was developed, which makes the Fischer-Tropsch process much more efficient and, among other things, more competitive with naturally produced oil, oil pumped out of the ground. Plus, with all of the instability we're seeing in the Middle East in particular, with not only the increased competition for petroleum and fossil fuel reserves by the growing industrial powers of India and China, but also in particular the growing instability in the Middle East, war in Iraq, war in Israel/Palestine, and war soon perhaps in Iran, or war perhaps between Turkey and Kurdistan. Who knows? But the more the war drums beat, whether they actually presage conflict or are only warning of its possibilities, and in particular with nuclear war drums beating, watch what happens to the price of oil. Well, that in turn, since just about everything and everybody uses petroleum directly and or indirectly, it is precipitating a massive global-wide transfer of wealth into the pockets of petroleum-producing industries, both companies and countries. It also, by the way, is creating a market in the petroleum industry in which the synthetically produced oil, basically a market in which oil produced from coal by the Fischer-Tropsch process can become competitive. And we're going to update our coverage of that. Among the institutions perhaps looking to take advantage of the Fischer-Tropsch process is the United States Air Force. I would also note that Richard Branson of Virgin Airways is exploring the possible utilization of this technology as well. Among the critics of this are people who allege that the Pentagon does not need its own fuel supply, and people who also warn about the fact that apparently the Fischer-Tropsch process releases an awful lot of greenhouse gases and heat-producing gases into the atmosphere. The article that I'm about to read does not touch on the issue of the catalyst, so I don't know if the statistics that are being cited by the environmental critics of the Fischer-Tropsch process are using statistics for the, quote, old, unquote, Fischer-Tropsch process. In other words, the non catalyst-assisted Fischer-Tropsch process, or whether they are up to snuff, so to speak, whether they are up to speed and are talking about the new, improved, so to speak, catalyst-assisted hydrogenation process that I've spoken about in the programs dealing with and updating the formula. Turning now to the Wall Street Journal of Tuesday, September 11th of 2007, an article by Matthew Dalton, headline, Coal Industry Hopes Pentagon Will Kindle a Market. Subheaded, used as liquid fuel is an aim, but cost and pollution are issues. Or use as liquid fuel is an aim, but cost and pollution are issues. It's by Matthew Dalton. It reads in part, the coal industry wants the U.S. military to jumpstart a major new market for its product, liquid transportation fuels derived from coal. The effort, however, faces skeptics who say the Pentagon shouldn't be subsidizing the high cost and potential environmental harm of what is known as coal-to-liquids technology. The debate, unfolding in Washington, underscores the difficulty of finding alternatives to oil in a time of global supply concerns. Unconventional sources, from Canada's vast tar sands to natural gas liquids to ethanol, promise to supplement supplies of crude from difficult-to-reach or politically unstable regions. Yet these sources face their own challenges, with cost often a major stumbling block. Expanding coal demand beyond the traditional uses of generating electricity and making steel could lead to big profits for both coal miners and companies that develop coal-to-liquids technology. Greg Boyce, chief executive of major coal miner Peabody Energy of St. Louis, said at a conference last week that using coal to make transportation fuel could increase U.S. coal demand by 1 billion tons by 2030, compared with demand of 1.2 billion tons in 2006. The problem is the plants that do the job are expensive to build and are profitable only if the price of crude stays well above $40 per barrel, according to industry estimates. By the way, it is now more than twice that. And with the war drums beating in the Middle East, by the way, this is Dave editorializing here, it is now over $80 a barrel. And with war drums beating in the Middle East, it might get higher than that. So, yes, it is very profitable indeed. Thank you. And with some of the very, very powerful companies controlling the Standard IG agreement, which governs the use of Fischer-Tropsch process, they stand to make a great deal of money by the use of this. And then the coal companies obviously also stand to make a lot of money as well. They're often very closely linked. Continuing here and repeating the last sentence, the problem is the plants that do the job are expensive to build and are profitable only if the price of crude stays well above $40 per barrel, according to industry estimates. Benchmark light sweet crude is currently trading above $70 a barrel on New York future markets, but the oil markets over the long term have proven susceptible to spikes and drops. Yesterday on the New York Mercantile Exchange, crude for October delivery rose 1% to settle at $77.49 a barrel. The plants, therefore, need military support to get built, Mr. Boyce said. Lining up the $8 billion worth of capital without baseload offtake agreements is a challenge today, unquote. A commitment from the Defense Department to buy fuel above the break-even production cost could ease doubts about the technology. That would require a change to federal procurement laws, an effort backed by the coal industry and some Pentagon officials, but challenged by skeptics and some lawmakers. The industry says the value of a natural fuel resource in the U.S., home to some of the world's largest coal reserves, should be worth the higher cost of fuel made from coal. Political instability in the Middle East, along with declining global oil reserves, will pose more serious threats to the military's fuel supply over the next two decades, the industry argues. Competition for global oil is only going to get more intense and more pricey, unquote, said Corey Henry, spokesman for the Coal to Liquids Coalition, a group representing miners and coal to liquids technology companies. The coal to liquids process, known as Fischer-Tropsch, is a proven technology, proponents say. Nazi Germany derived about half the military fuel it used in World War II from the Fischer-Tropsch process. South Africa relied heavily on the process because of international sanctions in the apartheid era that limited the country's ability to import oil. Others are skeptical. They say the armed forces buy and consume a large percentage of fuel overseas, making it less useful to rely on fuels produced domestically. If the military wants to develop an assured supply of domestically available fuel, one option would be to create a military petroleum reserve that could be tapped in a crisis. Skipping down yet again, the effort nevertheless has some backers at the Pentagon. The Air Force, which consumes the most fuel of the military services, supports using coal-to-liquids fuel. It recently certified the B-52 bomber to run on a blend of Fischer-Tropsch fuel and normal fuel. The Air Force plans to do the same for its entire fleet by 2011. The Air Force intends to buy about 400 million gallons annually by 2016. The service supports legislation that would allow it to sign 25-year contracts for supply, even at historically high prices above $50 per barrel, said William Anderson, Assistant Secretary of the Air Force for Installations, Environment, and Logistics. Skipping down again. The Coal to Liquids Coalition hopes to extend the contracting authority to 25 years. Earlier this year, the House rejected several provisions that would provide loan guarantees and tax breaks for coal-to-liquid plants as part of comprehensive energy legislation moving through Congress. Changing the military's contracting authority is now probably the coal industry's best chance of receiving federal support. So note again the Fischer-Tropsch process. No, folks, that's not the title of a band. That's the title of the hydrogenation process developed by IG Farben in the early 1920s, utilized to great advantage in World War II, and the moribund technology that I said would await the coming of a catalyst, as foreshadowed in the novel The Formula, and that novel, by the way, by Steve Shagan, and made into a major motion picture, starring, among others, George C. Scott and Marlon Brando. Just as I forecast in For the Record program number 385, dealing with the formula, just such a catalyst has been developed, and sure enough, once again, the Fischer-Tropsch process is back in business. Just how long it stays and just how much in business it's going to be, we will see, but it is back, and I told you so. Over the years, I've covered the bombing of Pan Am Flight 103, and over the years, I've indicated that there's a great deal more to that event than the official version of that story. Among the many important tributaries coming through the real story of the bombing of Pan Am 103 concerns some of the nefarious elements that were utilized in the Iran-Contra scandal, including drug smuggler and terrorist extraordinaire Manzer El-Kassar, a man credited by the DEA with having imported more than 20% of the heroin that was brought into the United States in the 1980s, an individual who was one of the world's major terrorist assisters and arms traffickers, but yet an individual who, because of his connections, was utilized in a number of capacities, including purchasing East Bloc arms for use by the Contras. Manzer El-Kassar also played a significant role, according to many sources, in the bombing of Pan Am 103 itself, but the official version, the official authorship for that event eventually fell on some Libyan intelligence agents. In our many discussions of the bombing of Pan Am 103, we've spoken about, among other links, some elements of the German Federal Police and German intelligence, who also were linked to some of the people involved with the bombing of Pan Am 103. What we're going to look at next concerns some apparently altered evidence and some apparently pressured testimony on the part of a technical expert to support that altered and therefore fallacious evidence has emerged, as basically there are now some serious doubts beginning to emerge about the official version of the bombing of Pan Am 103. One of the things that is interesting about Pan Am 103 is that a group of military intelligence operatives, the McKee team, that had been in Lebanon and in the Middle East trying to find out about U.S. hostages that were being held in Lebanon, had come across the collaboration between the Iran-Contra team, so to speak, under the Reagan and Bush administrations, and the aforementioned Manzer El-Kassar. The McKee team, however, never got to publicize their knowledge of that connection because they were killed in the bombing of Pan Am 103. One of the people, too, who was very much involved with the Iran-Contra affair, whose name also crops up in connection with the discussion of the McKee team and its connections. That is the elder George Bush, who really was the guy who was running the Iran-Contra affair. I would also note that the official investigation in this country of the bombing of Pan Am 103 was conducted by none other than then U.S. Attorney Robert Mueller, currently head of the FBI. And so, in light of the portentous political curricula vitae, the political resumes of many people that were involved in the official version of the bombing of Pan Am 103, remembering all of that, let's hear about how the evidence appears to have been, at least in part, deliberately fabricated. The following is from The Guardian, and this particular article comes from actually from the London Observer. It's by the European correspondent for the Observer, Alex Duval Smith. It's headlined, "Vital Lockerbie Evidence Was Tampered With," unquote. It's subheaded, "Fragments of bomb timer that helped to convict a Libyan ex-agent were practically carbonized," unquote, before the trial, says bankrupt Swiss businessman. The key piece of material evidence used by prosecutors to implicate Libya in the Lockerbie bombing has emerged as a probable fake. Nearly two decades after Pan Am Flight 103 exploded over Scotland on December 21st of 1988, allegations of international political intrigue and shoddy investigative work are being leveled at the British government, the FBI, and the Scottish police as one of the crucial witnesses, Swiss engineer Ulrich Lumpert, has apparently confessed that he lied about the origins of a crucial timer, evidence that helped tie the man convicted of the bombing to the crime itself. The Lockerbie disaster killed 270 people when the London to New York Boeing 747 exploded in midair. Britain and the U.S. blamed Libya, saying that its leader, Colonel Muammar Gaddafi, wanted revenge for the U.S. bombing of Tripoli in 1986. At a trial in the Netherlands in 2001, former Libyan agent Abdelbaset al-Megrahi was jailed for life. He is currently serving his sentence in Greencock Prison, but later this month the Scottish Court of Appeal is expected to hear Megrahi's case after the Scottish Criminal Cases Review Commission ruled in June that there was enough evidence to suggest a miscarriage of justice. Lumpert's confession, which was given to police in his home city of Zurich last week, will strengthen Megrahi's appeal. The Zurich-based Swiss businessman Edwin Bollier, B-O-L-L-I-E-R, who has spent nearly two decades trying to clear his company's name, is as eager for the appeal as is Megrahi. Bollier's now bankrupt company, Mebo, M-E-B-O, manufactured the timer switch that prosecutors used to implicate Libya after they said that fragments of it had been found on a Scottish hillside. Now, remember this company, Mebo, that manufactured the timer switch that prosecutors used to implicate Libya. You can hear some more about this company as well. Continuing, Bollier of Mebo, parenthetically, now 70, admits having done business with Libya. Quote, 2 years before Lockerbie, we sold 20 MST-13 timers to the Libyan military. FBI agents and the Scottish investigators said one of those timers had been used to detonate the bomb. We were shown a fuzzy photograph, and I confirmed the fragments looked as though they came from one of our timers, unquote. However, Bollier was uneasy with the photograph he had been shown and asked to see the fragments. He was finally given permission in 1998 and traveled to Dumfries to see the evidence. I was shown fragments of a brown circuit board which matched our prototype. But when the MST-13 went into production, the timers contained green boards. I knew that the timers sold to Libya had green boards. I told the investigators this. Back in Switzerland, Bollier's company was in effect bankrupt, having faced a lawsuit from Pan Am and having lost major clients such as the German Federal Police, to which Mebo supplied communications equipment, and for whom, by the way, some of the people investigated in connection with the bombing worked as operatives and investigators, meaning the German Federal Police, who were a client of Mebo, which supplied the timer that was allegedly used in the bombing. So this gets more and more complicated, and the information, the testimony, and the qualified testimony of Mr. Bollier raises more questions than it answers. Continuing. In 2001, Bollier spent 5 days in the witness box at the Lockerbie trial at Camp Zeist in the Netherlands. Quote, I was a defense witness, but the trial was so skewed to prove Libyan involvement that the details of what I had to say was ignored. A photograph of the fragments was produced in court, and I asked to see the pieces again. When they were brought to me, they were practically carbonized. They had been tampered with since I had seen them in Dumfries." Unquote. Few people apart from conspiracy theorists and investigative journalists working on the case were prepared to believe Bollier until the end of last month, when Lumpert, one of his former employees, walked into a Zurich police station and asked to swear an affidavit before a notary. So, again, official doubts emerging, about the official version of the Lockerbie story, as with the Kennedy assassination, or so many investigations, that is long overdue. I would not hold my breath on any serious investigation of Pan Am 103, because, again, among the people whose reputations would be tarred would be Robert Mueller, who, shall we say, proved less than vigorous in his investigation of Pan Am 103, didn't come across the links to the Iran-Contra affair, didn't come across the links to George Bush, kind of like the way that Robert Mueller, then U.S. attorney, failed to come across the links, really, between the BCCI affair and the Iran-Contra affair, or between the BCCI affair and the Bush family. And, of course, eventually the BCCI milieu blossomed, to a certain extent at least, into the milieu of September 11th, and who should be sort of presiding over the FBI and its investigations of, among other things, up the money trail from September 11th, investigated by Operation Green Quest, Robert Mueller. And he has turned out to be, less than vigorous in his pursuit of Operation Green Quest and the money trail of September 11th as well. So, not all that surprising. By the way, vis-a-vis the German intelligence and federal police connections to some of the operational elements involved in the bombing of Pan Am 103, note also that there's a link between September 11th and the German links to the investigation of Pan Am 103 as well. The first international warrant ever sworn out against Osama bin Laden was for the murder of Sylvain Becker and his wife. Sylvain Becker was a former BKA agent, that's the Bundeskriminalamt, the German Federal Police. He was known as one of the experts within the BKA on Islamists and Islamist terrorism, but he claims he was basically forced out, rather kind of like John O'Neill, basically, and rather like Mike German, who was an expert on the FBI, in the FBI, on white supremacist groups. He was expert at infiltrating them and was reporting on hookups, operational hookups between white supremacist groups and Islamists, and requested permission to investigate them, but instead his investigation was discredited and he was eased out of the Bureau. Sylvain Becker was handled in a very similar fashion within the BKA. He was basically pushed out of the BKA. He then traveled to Libya to investigate, basically, the bombing of Pan Am 103. That's what he was investigating when he was killed, allegedly, by Osama bin Laden, or according to the international warrant, by Osama bin Laden. So Sylvain Becker, the German John O'Neill discussed in, among other programs, For the Record, pro-broadcast number 336, a very, very interesting link indeed to the bombing of Pan Am 103. One of the things that we've spoken about in connection with September 11th, and that concerns the Eastern European criminal connections to the milieu of Mohammed Atta and company in South and Central Florida. We're going to take that up at greater length, but one of the people we've spoken about was Wolfgang Barringer, and Wolfgang Barringer was, among other things, the pilot for Victor Kozeny, the Pirate of Prague, an individual who took advantage of, among other things, the privatization of the Czech Republic in order to build an enormous array of criminal activities. The person who presided over the privatization of the Czech Republic was Václav Klaus, now the president of the Czech Republic. He has been doing some interesting networking of late. The following is from the Salt Lake Tribune. The Salt Lake Tribune of September 26th of 2007 has the following. Cheney to address secret group. The Conservative Council for National Policy will meet in downtown Salt Lake. Vice President Dick Cheney will speak to a super-secret conservative policy group in Utah on Friday during his second trip to the state this year. Cheney will address the fall meeting of the Council for National Policy, a group whose self-described mission is to promote a, quote, free enterprise system, a strong national defense, and support for traditional Western values, unquote. The organization, made up of a few hundred powerful conservative activists, holds confidential meetings, and members are advised not to use the name of the group in communications, according to a New York Times profile of the group. Skipping down. Czech Republic President Václav Klaus is also expected to address the Council for National Policy's meeting in downtown Salt Lake City. After his speech, Cheney will meet with Klaus, the vice president's office said Tuesday. So some very, very, very interesting networking going on indeed there. And the following, I thought we'd conclude this on a light note. This is from Tuesday, September 11th of 2007. Fidel Castro says U.S. fooled world over September 11th. It's a Reuters story, Dateline Havana. Ailing Cuban leader Fidel Castro said the U.S. government misinformed Americans and the world about September 11th, echoing conspiracy theories about the terror attacks against the United States 6 years ago. In an essay read by a Cuban television presenter on Tuesday night, Castro said the Pentagon was hit by a rocket, not a plane, because no traces were found of its passengers. Today, one knows there was deliberate misinformation, unquote, wrote Castro, who has not appeared in public since July of 2006, when life-threatening surgery for a secret illness forced him to hand over power to his brother Raul Castro. Studying the impact of planes, similar to those that hit the Twin Towers, that had accidentally fallen on densely populated cities, one concludes that it was not a plane that crashed into the Pentagon, unquote, Castro said. Only a projectile could have caused the geometrically round hole that allegedly was made by the plane, he said. We were fooled like the rest of the planet's inhabitants, unquote, he wrote. Castro said the truth behind the September 11th attacks with hijacked planes that killed nearly 3,000 people will probably never be known. Castro's 4,256-word essay made no mention of Osama bin Laden and his militant Islamist al-Qaeda network behind the attacks on New York's World Trade Center and Washington. Skipping down again, Castro, who was the target of CIA assassination plots after his 1959 revolution, said Cuba tipped off U.S. security services in 1984 about a plan to kill then-President Ronald Reagan while he campaigned for re-election in North Carolina. The information provided by Cuba led to the arrest of a would-be assassin and foiled the plot, he wrote. Well, I've never heard about that, but it is interesting to see Fidel jumping on the truther bandwagon. By the way, that round hole, you'll see the picture all over the Internet. What it is a hole in the inner ring of the Pentagon. It's produced by the landing gear of the aircraft, one of the densest and strongest parts of that particular aircraft, and according to the Fort, or really of many aircrafts, but that basically was made the round hole. Anyway, that wraps up For the Record program number 612. Miscellaneous articles and updates being recorded on September 30th of 2007. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.